Part 2. Chapter 4. 847959 M41 Imperial Command Center, Olympax Mountains, Pythos. As he had done every day for a week since the shattered survivors of the assault on Attica had completed their deadly march through the Deathglades, Colonel Strike made his way through the secret tunnels of the Delver stronghold, ascending ever higher to his vantage point atop the range's highest peak. Unlike every previous occasion he had made this climb, this time he was being followed. His head-mounted loom strip shone through the cloying darkness, illuminating the route for both him and his unseen pursuer, and as he rounded the final corner and walked up the final steep slope, he switched it off as natural light began to filter in. Emerging into the red-hued dawn of Pythos, he took a deep breath and expelled the dank air of the stronghold's caverns, replacing it with a crisp, thin air of the mountains. Away in the distance, Attica Hive stood dark and silent, rising up out of the emerald jungle, like a grim memorial to the Catachan's defeat and the massive loss of life endured there. Cells of his men had stayed behind to run a counterinsurgency against the invaders, but not one of them had made contact since the rest of the regiment had fled the hive, and speculation was rife as to what new horrors the enemy had inflicted upon them. Even then, they may have been the lucky ones. Of the nearly 11,000 Catachans who had made it out of Attica, a little more than half of that had survived. Those who perished had not fallen to the guns and blades of the enemy, but were instead claimed by the hostile wildlife of the Death World's jungles. Abaddon's forces had not pursued them, and whether that was down to allowing the jungle to do the work of soldiers or other darker reasons, was the source of as much speculation as the fate of those who remained in Attica.
"Please, don't tell me you come up here for the view, Colonel Strike," said a woman's voice from the tunnel behind him. "I'd hate to think you're becoming sentimental."
Strike's fang was in his hand, and clear of its sheath, before she'd even uttered his name. Fortunately for Zula, with her newly cropped hair, he identified her before he could inflict any damage with it.
"Are there no secrets from the likes of you?"
Strike said, shaking his head but smiling. He safely stowed his blade back at his hip.
"All part of my job,"
Zula replied warmly. In the week since Strike had emerged from the Death Glades at the head of a column of his men, he'd formed an uneasy relationship with the junior inquisitor. Though he still placed the blame for the invasion squarely with Dinalt and his cohort, Zula had already proven to be a valuable asset, and in Brigston's absence had begun training 3 dozen of his men how to tame and train some of Pythos's smaller saurians so that they could expand their patrols deeper into the jungle. Her Xenos pet had proved his worth too, ensuring that the few Valkyries and other flyers that had made it to Olympax stayed airworthy, allowing Strike to order rapid missions of opportunity whenever and wherever they presented themselves.
"And what of your secret? Are you ready to tell me who that second message was intended for? Can we expect salvation, or were you double-crossing us like your blonde friend?"
"She was never my friend," Zula said coldly. "And if you really believed that I was a traitor too, that knife of yours would be between my ribs, not sheathed at your hip," she added, warmth returning to her voice.
"True enough. But if you really were sending for aid, I don't understand why you're being so clandestine about it."
"If the message made it through, you'd understand soon enough." A noise in the distance caught her attention, and shielding her eyes, she looked in the direction of the rising sun. "Ah, I think your little secret is about to be revealed, Colonel."
Silhouetted against the pink disk slowly rising on the horizon, 4 Valkyries slowly made their way towards the makeshift Imperial Command Center, engines whining in protest at the great cargo slung between them. As they struggled to keep formation, the bulky object, almost the size of the 4 flyers combined, swung precariously from thick chains, threatening to send the aircraft crashing through the canopy below.
"What in the name of the throne is that?" Zula asked.
"Why don't you come and find out?"
Strike said, hitting the activation stud on his loom strip and climbing back down into the gloom of the stronghold. The hangar, more used to accommodating the dirigibles that transported Pythosian crystal to the spaceports at the planet's poles, was teeming with Catachans, so many that it was impossible to make out what the squad of Valkyries had delivered. Men and women, all clad in camouflage pattern fatigues, green vests and red bandanas, swarmed over the new arrival, obfuscating its outline as they clambered over it.
"Attain! Hut!"
Major Thorne bawled, noticing that the Colonel and Junior Inquisitor had entered the hangar. Within seconds, the green cover melted away, circling the rusted object beneath in an impromptu honour guard.
"Is that a..." Zula began.
"It is," said Strike, as if it was the second coming of the Emperor himself. "It's a hellhammer." Coated in millennia of rust, the Baneblade variant more closely resembled a mobile fortress than a super-heavy battle tank, even in its dilapidated condition. A huge hellhammer cannon, from which the tank drew its pattern name, was mounted into its turret, and a demolisher cannon and autocannon were positioned beneath it. Along its thickly armoured hull, two sponsons sat either side, housing a las cannon and heavy flamer in each. Pintle-mounted in front of the turret was a huge heavy bolter. None of them looked like they were in working condition, and though the tank still had treads, close to half the links were missing.
It's...
Zula struggled to find the words.
"One of the finest military machines ever to roll out of a forge world? The most glorious relic of the Imperium you've ever cast your eyes upon? A miracle that the Emperor saw fit to bless us with by leaving it for us to find in the jungle."
Strike proffered.
"It's a wreck," Zula concluded. "Why did you waste time and effort hauling this thing back here? None of the weapon systems are operational, and you'll be waiting until doomsday to get the engine running."
As if to spite her, the hangar filled with a chug-chug of the ancient Phaeton thermic combustor, attempting to turn over. That was quickly followed by the roar of its springing to life, accompanied by a thick cloud of sooty black smoke pouring forth from the engine vents. A cheer, louder than the sound of the tank's engine, went up from the assembled Catachans, and Zula felt her cheeks flush in embarrassment at her previous pronouncement. A second wave of appreciation sounded out as the top hatch sprung open and an orange-furred hand sprang out of it, making a thumbs-up gesture, soon followed by the rest of KC.
"You were saying?"
Strike said, smugly. 888959 M41. Hesedicus Stronghold, Hesedicus Pythos. The agonized screams of the dying merged with a roar of blue flame as the fire engulfed its victims, melting flesh, rending fat, and scorching bone. 9 times 9 was the required sacrifice, and warp fire was the method by which they were to be slaughtered. Corpulax had seen to the first requirement when he had stormed the Delver stronghold and made prisoners of the Catachans who fought in vain to defend it. Abaddon had fulfilled the second by supplying the Plague Lord with a seemingly endless stream of sorcerers, so numerous were the cabals who had rallied to his cause. The death cries echoed around the huge subterranean chamber, in which the sixth seal to the Damnation Cache was located before dying down. The sound of bubbling tallow and the unholy dirge of sorcerous chanting struck up in its place. The discordant wail reached a crescendo before, as quickly as the sapphire flame had been conjured into being, it dissipated, the only sign of it ever existing being the molten mass of human waste smoking on the expansive rocky floor. One of the sorcerers, a tall, wiry figure whose neck was adorned with many rings, giving it a bizarre, elongated appearance, stepped towards Corpulax, who had observed proceedings from the mouth of the chamber.
"It is done, Lord Corpulax. The penultimate seal is broken, and we edge ever closer to reopening the Damnation Cache."
His voice was reed-thin and laced with venom.
"Prepare the ritual. I will inform Lord Abaddon of our success and apprise him of our next objective," said Corpulax.
At a signal from the sorcerer, a prisoner was brought before Corpulax and thrust unceremoniously to his knees.
Whereas the sacrificial Catachans had been prime specimens, this one, a young captain of the 183rd, was bedraggled. His face and limbs had bloated to unnatural proportions and had a jaundiced tone to them. Pus wept from his tear ducts and nostrils, mingling with a viscous sweat that coated his flesh.
"Please!"
he rasped through lungs full of noxious fluid. Corpulax leant forward and gently placed the forefinger of his skeletal hand to the Catachan's mouth. The captain's lips and tongue desiccated the instant they were touched, the dead flesh dropping to the floor and forming an ash-like mound at the plague marine's feet.
"Hush!"
Corpulax said to the man, who was tentatively touching his lower jaw, not sure of what had just happened.
"We need your silence for this."
Almost on cue, the Cabal struck up their chant again, this time more rhythmically, in a harder, more guttural language than the one used to break the seal. The kneeling Catachan's flesh started to writhe as if things were moving around it subdermally, like rats or mice had got beneath the skin and were scurrying about inside him. When it looked like the flesh was about to tear, the chanting stopped, and Corpulax uttered a single word that turned the Catachan inside out. Lungs and other internal organs burst forth from a mouth that was stretched impossibly wide, followed by muscle, sinew, and other less identifiable parts of the human anatomy. As the pile of innards spilled onto the rock floor, they took on new form, twisting and manipulating, tearing and reshaping. Thigh bone flattened and expanded until it resembled a spiked pauldron. Deltoid separated to create the likeness of a power claw. Wrist tendons rotated around each other to form a topknot. When the simulacrum of Abaddon was complete, it spoke to Corpulax through a mouth made of repurposed appendix.
"Is the seal broken, Plague Lord? Or is this yet another one of your requests for me to send you more warlocks you can burn out?"
The rendering of Abaddon's body had been appropriated from somebody else's, but the voice was most definitely his own.
"It is broken, my master."
Although he was not actually in the presence of the War Master, Corpulax still took to one knee out of deference.
"And I have yet more good news. Our agents believe they have located the final seal." "If your information is accurate, the Black Legion themselves will be at your disposal to ensure it is broken."
"It is not as simple as that, Lord. There are complications."
The flesh Abaddon scowled, cheeks of calf muscle tensing.
"Several thousand of the galaxy's finest warriors should be enough to resolve any complication. My warriors have spent weeks scouring the surface of this planet for the likely locations of the seals. I shall give them the purpose they were bred for."
"My lord, the final seal is located directly below the Delver stronghold at Olympax."
"Where the savages have established their new base. We would have eliminated them already if we hadn't been scouring the jungle for weeks. Olympax will burn. I will have their commander's head upon a stake, and the final seal will be opened. Then my hunt can begin in earnest, and you can turn your attention to opening the Emerald Cave."
"With all due respect, Lord Abaddon," Corpulax lied, "the Olympax stronghold and the surrounding mountains are the most defensible location on the planet. The slopes approaching it are sheer and slow going. Even an airborne assault would be catastrophic, as the bulk of their anti-aircraft weapons and flyers survived the initial assault.
And an orbital strike is out of the question, as that risks destroying the seal before it can be opened,"
Abaddon snorted.
"Is that why you contacted me, Plague Lord? To tell me that our only option is a risky suicide mission that may result in failure because an Imperial Guard regiment had the blind fortune to base themselves right on top of our objective?" There is another option, one that is less direct, but offers us our greatest chance of success. Subterfuge. I thought that was the preserve of our Nzichian brethren.
I am nothing if not pragmatic, Lord. I believe I can get a cell into the Olympic stronghold and break the seal from within without interference from Imperial forces. It may take us longer to achieve, but with a final seal broken, the cache will open and our allies will make short work of the cowering Catachans.
The Abaddon Thing nodded in approval. I hope you are right, Plague Lord. Because if you aren't, and our mission on Pythos fails, I will hunt you until the ends of eternity, and personally flay your soul. His final utterance complete, Abaddon remotely broke the spell, and the simulacrum collapsed into a wet heap of offal. Corpulax turned to the throng of cultists and sorcerers who had stood witness to his communion, and addressed one in particular.
"Have your cell ready to move out within the hour," Corpulax said.
He reached down to his hip with his gauntleted hand and removed a vial of dark liquid from a pouch at his belt. He offered it to the robed cultist, who accepted it with a feminine hand.
"You know what this is, and you know when to use it. Do not fail me like your master did."
The robed figure pulled back her hood to reveal the blonde stubble of freshly shaved hair.
"Our success is assured," she said,
carefully placing the vial into the leather satchel hanging over her shoulder. 913959, M41, Hangar Level, Imperial Command Center, Olympax Mountains, Pythos. It was the sound of a sputtering Valkyrie engine in the distance that drew Major Eckhart Thorne's attention from the other flyers undergoing repairs in the hangar. Field engineers put down their spanners and blowtorches and turned their heads towards the vast opening in the mountainside that allowed the Imperial aircraft easy access. A trail of thick black smoke denoted the crazed route through the sky the Valkyrie had taken as the pilot struggled to keep it in the air with only one working engine. The craft jinked uneasily as it approached the Imperial base.
"Who's piloting that thing?"
Thorne asked a bearded officer who had stopped whatever it was he'd been doing to watch the stricken flyer. Many of the other Catachans in the hangar also sported substantial facial hair, the niceties of personal grooming set aside while at war.
"I don't know, sir," the officer replied. "All of our birds are accounted for."
Thorne stroked his own thick stubble and furrowed his brow.
"The most recent contact we had from the colonel had them several hours flying away from Olympax. Even with a light load, an advanced scout wouldn't have made it back this quickly."
For the past few weeks, Strike and the bulk of the Olympax contingent had been defending Khan's hold from an enemy assault. And though the counterattack had been a success, the colonel had stayed on there for some time afterwards, wary of a second attack wave, and to mop up small guerrilla bands of cultists in the surrounding jungle.
"It could be an enemy trick. Shall we shoot it down?" the officer suggested.
Thorne thought for a moment. The noise of the malfunctioning engine was louder now, and the Valkyrie would be attempting its landing within seconds. If this was some underhand ploy by the invaders, he did not have long to make the call.
"Stand down," Thorne said at the last possible moment. "Those markings on its hull are Devil's Brigade, who are based at Hesodicus. We lost contact with them weeks ago, but just in case..."
He drew his las pistol and checked how much charge was left in its cell. The screaming of the Valkyrie became a high-pitched whine as the pilot struggled to find the altitude to get his craft through the hangar opening. Buffeted by crosswinds, it tossed from side to side, coming close to smashing against the mountainside more than once.
"He's not going to make it. He's not going to make it,"
the officer beside Thorne muttered. All around the hangar, money started changing hands as the Catachans began to wager on the success or failure of the Valkyrie's landing. With meters to spare, The pilot caught an updraft, and the Valkyrie popped up into the view of those assembled in the hangar. The dark humour gave way to panic as it became apparent to everyone that the flyer wasn't going to come to a fiery end on the slopes of Mount Olympus, but was instead going to crash, possibly quite spectacularly, right among them. The sound of scraping metal rang out around the chamber as the pilot barely made it over the lip of the hangar entrance and sheared off the undercarriage. Sparks trailing in its wake, the Valkyrie skidded along the hangar floor, forcing Catachans to dive out of its way. The further into the hangar it slid, the more its momentum was arrested, and, after bouncing off two berthed flyers, causing only minor damage, it came to a halt scant metres from the back wall. Nothing happened for what seemed like an age, until, just as prone Catachans started raising themselves from the floor, now that the threat of explosion had passed, the rear hatch of the Valkyrie opened with a hydraulic hiss. Obscured by the smoke still pluming from the ravaged engine, several figures descended the ramp. Thorn raised his pistol in their direction. "Stop right there! Name and rank! Now!" The smoke parted, revealing five figures, all dressed in identical fatigues and vests, blood-red bandanas tied tightly around their scalps. A woman, the only one among the group, took a step forwards. Thorn lifted the pistol so that he was looking straight down the barrel at her head. "I said stop!" Others in the hangar had drawn weapons, and they too were trained on the newcomers. "Give me your name and rank now!"
"Captain Troy, Devil's Brigade," the woman said matter-of-factly. "We're all that's left of the garrison at Hesodicus."
Thorn looked her up and down, pistol still aimed at her head. On the surface, she looked like a Catachan, but there was something about the woman that didn't ring true. Her hair was too freshly shorn where it was visible at the base of her skull, and her fingernails were clean. He'd also never heard of a Captain Troy, but in a regiment the size of the 183rd, it was impossible to keep track of or know the identity of every soldier.
"Devil's Brigade, you say?"
Thorn took a few steps closer to her, never lowering his weapon.
"Hesodicus sounds tough if you were the only ones to walk away. Still, I bet it was nothing compared to the Battle of Khor Ila."
The woman looked him squarely in the eyes.
"I don't know what you mean, Major. Devil's Brigade didn't fight at Khor Ila. We were engaged deep behind enemy lines at Mortlach at the time."
Thorn grinned and lowered his last pistol. The other weapons, pointed at the troops from Hesodicus, did likewise. Captain Troy had not only passed his little test, she had passed it with distinction.
"Can't be too careful, Captain," Thorn reholstered his weapon. "Hesodicus is gone, you say?"
"It fell days ago. Total annihilation," she said, fingers scratching underneath her bandana. "Those of us that were left stayed behind to harry the enemy, but when our numbers got so few that we were ineffective, I decided it was time for us to get out. We're more use here as part of the larger resistance effort."
"Glad to have you, Captain. Mulgrew," he called to the bearded officer, "take Captain Troy and her men to Major Raistan and have him redeploy them."
The woman saluted lazily. Thorn returned it in kind. Mulgrew was about to lead the five reinforcements out of the hangar when Thorn spoke again.
"And Mulgrew?"
"Yes, sir. What is it?"
"Have that Valkyrie stripped down and used for spares when you get back," Thorn said, gesturing with his thumb to the wreck at the back of the hangar.
Mulgrew nodded and continued on his way, Troy and her men in tow. In a secluded corner of the hangar, somebody else had stopped their repair work to view the spectacle of the crashing Valkyrie and the subsequent entrance of the new arrivals. However, unlike Thorn, they knew that Captain Troy and her men were not what they claimed to be. Removing his welding mask, KC jumped down from the hull of the Hellhammer and loped off to find Zula.
"Sounds like Hesodicus was a bit of bad business," Mulgrew said, as he led Troy and her men through the narrow man-made caverns of Olympax.
Before the invasion of Pythos, Olympax had been one of the main Delver strongholds on the planet, its high, easily defended location making it a haven from the predation of the jungle's inhabitants.
Where once it had been home to the bulk of the world's crystal production, now it played temporary home to the bulk of its defenders.
It was a bloodbath, the woman in the captain's uniform replied. Not a single soul got out of there alive.
Except for you five, of course, sir, Mulgrew added cheerfully.
No, not even we survived. I mean, we did, obviously, but the former owners of these filthy rags are as dead as you.
She drew the stolen blade from her thigh and jabbed it hard into Mulgrew's throat before he could react. The Catachan sank to his knees, hands clamped around his neck, vainly trying to stem the flow of arterial blood.
Nobody survived. Those I didn't kill myself, I watched die. Like Troy here.
She pulled at the chain around her neck to reveal a set of dog tags from beneath her vest.
It took him an age to die under the ministrations of the interrogator acolytes of the Divinicus Lycae. But before he breathed his last, he told us all that we needed to know to pass ourselves off as members of your regiment.
She rotated the Catachan fang in her hand so that the blade pointed towards the ground and stabbed down hard, driving it through Mulgrew's temple. Then she withdrew it with a wet pop and, removing the red bandana from her head, wiped the knife clean before scabbarding it. Throwing the bloodied rag to the ground next to the corpse of the Catachan officer, Tryphena Brand led her infiltration team deeper into the stronghold. 913959, M41, East Entrance Imperial Command Center, Olympax Mountains, Pythos.
Be ready to head out again at first light,
Zula Degrees ordered as she swung her legs from the saddle and dismounted the Arbosaur.
Just because the enemy have left us alone until now doesn't mean it'll stay that way forever.
She received nods from the half a dozen Catachans who accompanied her on patrol as they stretched and twisted, trying to work out the knots of hours in the saddle. Though not a Catachan herself, Zula had proven a capable tutor when it came to taming and riding the beasts, and those under her command had grudgingly accepted her once she had proven her worth. Handing the reins of her mount to one of the Catachans who would lead the beast away to the pens, she removed her bandana and wiped sweat from her forehead. With her body glove ruined in the battle for Attica, she had taken to dressing in a similar fashion to the Death Worlders, and her fatigues and green vest matched those of the 183rd perfectly. What she didn't copy, for fear of causing offence, was the red bandanas they wore, instead choosing a black square of cloth that she wore wrapped like a headband. Regardless, she'd still look like a Catachan to the enemy rather than a servant of the Ordos, which is precisely the way she wanted it if they were, as she suspected, hunting for the knife. She was about to remove the rest of her outfit and hit the makeshift showers just inside the cave mouth of the east entrance when KC emerged from out of the base. He looked excited or agitated and bounded over to Zula before grabbing her arm and tugging on it.
"What is it, Casey? Have you finished working on Strike's tank and want to show me?"
She gripped the bottom of her vest in preparation to pull it off over her head.
"Give me a while to shower, and I'll be right with you."
KC shook his head vigorously, his ample cheeks flapping as he did so. He tugged on Zula's arm again. She stopped trying to undress and began to take him seriously.
I don't understand.
The Jacaro released his tight grip on her arm and placed one hand on each of his ears. He pulled them so that they stuck out and blew hard with his mouth closed to inflate his cheeks. With his impersonation finished, he jabbed out a finger and pointed upwards into the base. Suddenly understanding, Zula drew her plasma pistol.
"Show me."
"Now," she said, following the diminutive Xenos back into the caves of Olympax.